You know, Hurricane Irma is going to continue to play an impact on commodities and futures for the weeks ahead. The impact on OJ and cotton specifically, we won't see that until the USDA report. But if you look at the wind gusts going through that area, the key level on the citrus crop is 75 miles an hour. That's where it can continue to hang onto the tree. So with it coming down below, into the 70s, we'll probably see the rest of the crop is okay.
After more than 13 hours of debate in Britain's parliament, Brexit is now another step closer. UK lawmakers backing a second reading of the EU withdrawal bill in the early hours of Tuesday. The bill is largely about cutting and pasting European law into British law to make sure the UK has the same regulatory framework as the EU at the moment Brexit is triggered.
Oil is the lifeblood of North Korea's effort to build and deliver a nuclear weapon. Today's resolution reduces almost 30% of oil provided to North Korea by cutting off over 55% of its gas, diesel, and heavy fuel oil. Last month, we passed a resolution banning its coal and iron exports. Today's resolution bans all textile exports. That's an almost $800 million hit to its revenue.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Tuesday. It's September 12th, 2017, 5:11 in the morning. We're glad you're here with us for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. Lots to cover this morning. A little bit later on in the program, the golden ticket, the race for the golden ticket is underway. I think that's what we're going to call it, the new search for the Amazon HQ2. Headquarters 2 is underway, and communities all across the country have begun to throw their hat in the ring. Dale Buss will be here. We'll talk a little bit about the chances for the Midwest landing this, namely Chicago, maybe perhaps Detroit, some other cities. He'll be along later in the program. And in a minute, we'll bring in our first guest to talk about the cost of disasters and making sure that we spend every penny of recovery money properly. Our expert from SIU will talk to us about this. He's been studying disasters for much of his career, and we will go into some of that. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, futures are pointing to another positive open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are up 42 points. NASDAQ futures are up about 11. In Asia this morning, markets are generally higher as well, with the Nikkei up about 230 points. That's good for a percent. The Hang Seng up just a fraction. Pretty much the same story with the Shanghai as well. And in Europe, markets are mixed. The FTSE is off just a fraction this morning, down about 13 points. The DAX in Germany is up about 66 points. That's good for a half a percent. Pretty much the same story this morning in France as well, with the CAC up about 28 points or a half a percent. Oil is lower this morning by a half a percent, almost $47.87 a gallon. With that off about 20 cents. A couple of stories that we're watching. The Wisconsin Senate poised today to approve nearly $3 billion in cash payments for Taiwan-based Foxconn Technology Group. It's an unprecedented incentive package for the electronics company to locate a flat-screen factory in the state, probably in the southeast portion of the state. Could create thousands of jobs and be a multi-year, if not a decade-long, generator of economy and jobs in that part of the region. Also, British lawmakers voted a key bill passed, a big first hurdle in Parliament early today. Many lawmakers there branded the bill a government power grab and vowed to change it before it becomes law. After a debate that stretched past midnight, the House of Commons backed the European Withdrawal Union Withdrawal Bill by a vote of 326 to 290. That means lawmakers approved the bill in principle, but the government will now face attempts to amend it before a final vote later this year. Also, today's a big day for Apple. It is the day the company has its unveiling, likely to see a new iPhone, maybe iPhone X and iPhone 8 together. The iPhone X celebrating the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone, maybe a $1,000 phone coming today from iPhone, Apple. It's 5:14 now. Our first guest has been dealing and studying and researching disasters much of his life, much of his career. And we thought we'd bring him in today to talk a little bit about Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Roberto Barrios is Associate Professor of Anthropology, also the co-chair of Risk and Disaster for TIG SFAA. Roberto, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
From SIU Carbondale, we should mention, where you do most of your work. I'm sure you've been watching the hurricanes Harvey and Irma closely. What are your takeaways, first of all?
Takeaways are that if we social scientists like to say, disasters are not discrete events. Disasters are usually historical processes that extend the temporal span of a disaster way before a hurricane makes landfall. Disasters often are engendered through daily development and social practices that usually have long histories before something like a hurricane or an earthquake occurs. And they also unfold long afterwards. And one of the things that I think is the takeaway is who's going to be affected how, who's going to be recovered quicker than whom. One of the things I've already seen with Harvey, just doing research, haven't only been watching but also reading all of the excellent research that's been done by people like Dr. Robert Bullard, it showed that there are tremendous inequities in disaster risk and vulnerability, how it is distributed, who is at greater risk than whom in cities like Houston. And certainly there are important socioeconomic differences and also differences in terms of race and ethnicity of who lives close to chemical plants, who lives close to Superfund sites. And we're definitely going to see some tremendous social differences in who suffers how and for how long, and especially over the process of recovery.
I want to take a couple of those things first. I mean, when you say that disasters sort of are long in coming, are you talking about how we prepare for them? And is that played out sort of with Hurricane Harvey and Irma as well? Do you think the regions that were hit by those hurricanes were generally prepared for them?
And the fact that the people are differentially protected and prepared for them, you know, one of the things that I've been seeing with my reading up on the disaster is that some communities may have better flood protection than others. Some communities may also be in higher elevations than others. Therefore, the flood risk is even lesser. Some communities might have a history of being disenfranchised. Therefore, they are purposely underprepared, not by the people who reside within them, but by the broader society that often makes decisions about who is worthy of certain kinds of aid or even who is worthy of certain kind of protection mechanisms, things like levees, et cetera. And not only about the disaster preparedness, but also that disasters are intimately related to how we develop things like urban areas. And you can see that, for example, in my work has been primarily in New Orleans. You can see the 300-year history of the development of the urban landmass of New Orleans. But there were very clear patterns where people of certain racial identities claimed certain areas to live that were often of higher elevation, less prone to flooding, and actually forced other folks. In the history of New Orleans, for example, African Americans have a long history of being forced to live in areas that are more flood-prone than others. In the case of the city of Houston, the work of Dr. Ballard has demonstrated that African-American communities and communities of color are primarily the ones who are relegated to living in areas where industrial operations take place, refining operations take place, Superfund sites take place. Therefore, when the flooding occurs, not only will they experience the disaster of the flood, they will also experience the disaster of the toxicity that will be released onto their environments by these floods. Therefore, it not only is it a matter of preparation or lack thereof, but the very way in which we develop our cities or urban areas often inequitably distribute disaster risk and the long-term impacts of disaster along lines of race, class, gender, age, and ethnicity.
Roberto, hang on with us. We're going to talk as we come back from our break here in conversation about what that means in terms of dollars as we continue our conversation with Roberto Barrios. He's an associate professor of anthropology at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and he is sort of an expert in hurricanes and disasters.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, Harvey and Irma and the U.S. economy. Damage estimates from the two storms are still early, particularly for Irma. Hurricane Harvey will likely cost up to $108 billion, according to some analysts' estimates. Mark Zandi of Moody Analytics estimates that Irma will cost $64 to $92 billion in damage. Asian shares were mostly higher today. On Wall Street Monday, the Standard & Poor's 500 index made its biggest gain since late April. It rose about 27 points. The Dow gained about 260 points, and the Nasdaq composite jumped about 72 points. Apple is expected to sell its fanciest iPhone yet for $1,000. The unveiling of a dramatically redesigned iPhone will likely likely be the marquee moment today when Apple hosts its first event in its new headquarters in Cupertino, California. Dave Schreiber, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program, 523. We're on this morning with Roberto Barrios. He's an associate professor of anthropology at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and an extensive researcher on our disasters. Roberto, I'm wondering, I know after Hurricane Harvey, you were taken aback by the level of damage. I wonder what you're thinking now after Irma as well.
Yes, absolutely. These are very costly disasters, and it's going to take a lot to recover. And one of the things we'll have to begin to ask is whether we can afford climate change in the United States right now, and certainly the stronger tropical storms and hurricanes that we'll be seeing as that unfolds.
Yeah, so you're one of those ones that wants. I know we have heard the last couple of days some of the Trump administration saying they don't want to talk about climate change, but it's probably a conversation we need to be having right now, isn't it?
Yes, because it's going to become a business conversation. Can insurance companies afford this? To what extent should the federal government be subsidizing things like flood insurance, which it had been cutting over the last few years? These are going to be huge issues about whether our society is sustainable, and there's not going to be no hiding from that.
On the high end, I've heard $290 billion as a cost for both of the disasters. It's obviously early, but if you kind of play that out over the course of several years, maybe even a decade, if we start having disasters like this every year, that will get costly very quickly, won't it?
Yes, yes. And if it was just the opening salvo, it's going to get very costly. And not just the cost in terms of dollars and cents, but the cost of the fact that as sea levels rise and as if we begin to see coastal erosion in areas like Louisiana, we will also lose livelihoods, lifestyles, we will lose cultures of people who live in those regions. And those are things that we can't even, we can't even factor in monetary terms. We have to think about it in terms of what they mean to us as a nation and as a people.
Is it too early to be thinking about, you know, whether or not we rebuild in some of these areas?
Yes, yes and no. This is the complexity of it, and this is what I saw in New Orleans. And in New Orleans, there were certain prescriptions that were given that people suggested, well, maybe we shouldn't live in low-lying areas. And I'm not going to deny that there's a certain sense to that decision, but the thing about disasters is that we also had to understand that the areas that we're making decisions about whether to rebuild or not are also areas where society existed. And it's a society that does continue to have certain inequities in terms of ethnicity and race, in terms of who is allowed to live where and the meanings that certain neighborhoods and places take for people. So while I do agree that we should take a hard look at certain areas that are flood-prone, we should also understand that until we resolve, and I think it's very clear also, as you were mentioning, the current administration that wanted to talk about climate change, you also need to talk about issues of race, faith, and disaster risk in the society. So one thing is to say maybe we should not rebuild certain neighborhoods because they're low-lying areas, but we also had to take a look at who lived there. Were the people who lived there, did they live there because they were relegated to live to those areas? Because in many parts of Louisiana, where you actually in the United States, where you actually see de facto policies of racial profiling, that you have certain forms of de facto segregation that is taking place that relegates certain groups of people to live in certain areas. So while if we do not resolve those issues as well, disasters are holistic events. That if we're going to talk about people not rebuilding in certain areas, we have to also address issues of environmental and social injustice. And so it's a little bit, arbitrary to say we will only think about whether we should rebuild in areas that are flood-prone. If we are going to do that, then we also have to address these very painful and yet still very present, as we saw with the protests in Charlottesville, that issues of race, faith, and class are still very much a part of our society, and they're intimately tied into how a disaster is given form and magnitude through our urban development practices. So, yes, I agree, maybe low-lying areas should not be reconstructed, but let's not think that those areas are areas that are devoid of sometimes serious challenges and conflicts over issues of class and race that need to be resolved as well and negotiated amongst ourselves as American citizens.
Are we talking about years or a decade or more of getting back to normal after these two storms?
Yes. Years, decades. And for some people, it will never go back to normal. And that's where we also see the differentials of disasters. For people who I still continue to talk to in neighborhoods like Tremé in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, they're still living with the impacts of Hurricane Katrina. When you look at the fact that in 2013, 111,000 residents of New Orleans who self-identified as African-American had not been able to return to New Orleans because their neighborhoods, although they were some of the most affected, were because of the use of the free market model for the reconstruction, their neighborhoods were actually, like the lower ninth ward, were the last to receive any aid and receive minimal amounts of aid compared to other parts of the city. For those people, the disaster is still unfolding. And there were also many New Orleanians who had not been able to return to the city because their neighborhoods were deprioritized during the reconstruction, that were living in Houston when Harvey came. Therefore, they're now living the double trauma of double displacement. And that's what I mean about, as you were mentioning, how should we spend the money that we have? One of the things that social scientists say is that to understand disasters, you have to understand the social practices to inequitably distribute disaster vulnerability, and that's an issue of environmental justice. And therefore, when we think about how to spend the money on the reconstruction, certainly businesses need to come back, and we need to help the elements of the market. But we also need to take a very close look at issues of environmental injustice and follow an environmental justice agenda to make sure that those people who are most vulnerable and most heavily affected, and it was often not because they made a choice to live in a vulnerable situation, but often that they were relegated to those conditions in the societies that they live, that we actually make sure that we funnel the necessary resources towards them. Believe it or not, that did not happen with the reconstruction of Katrina. The adherence to a strict free market model left many people who were the most affected by the disaster, who were actually, and those effects were actually the side effect of the way that we developed New Orleans as a particular kind of port industrial center. Then we're going to see some people for whom it won't be a matter of 10 or 20 years, it'll be a matter of a lifetime of how the disaster affects.
Roberto, good of you to be with us this morning here in the opening bell. Thanks for the information.
Thank you.
All right. For Roberto Barrios is an associate professor of anthropology at SIU Carbondale, Southern Illinois University at Carbondale.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. 5:41 here on our Tuesday edition of the opening bell. The race is on to try to attract the Amazon headquarters to HQ2, as it's being called. A number of cities already have thrown their names into the hats for this big $50 billion investment. Perhaps a number of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs as well. Maybe it's $5 billion. I don't have my notes in front of me, but you know who would know, and that's D.L. Buss. He's a contributor at Forbes and Chief Exec Magazine. He's with us this morning from the Detroit area. Good morning, Dale.
Good morning. Yeah, it's $5 billion. It's possible to expand it over time, and as you said, potentially 50,000 jobs. All over or averaging over $100,000. So these are tech jobs, some management jobs, quite a plum for any city that could land Amazon's 2HQ. And, you know, in some ways, it's a very different cat than the Foxconn plant that Wisconsin landed, which is a manufacturing facility with larger investment but lower average annual salaries. I mean, this is very much a tech era site that Amazon, you know, wants to assemble. And it's just interesting. I mean, leave it to Amazon to do something different, right? They take over the retail world. They're making a public auction out of this whole thing, whereas the most recent big plum, Foxconn, was kind of conducted in secret with secret flights by Midwestern governors, you know, over to Taiwan. And that sort of thing. Amazon say, okay, this is what we're going to do. Everybody come and get it. So it's kind of just set off this economic development frenzy, if you will.
Yeah, sort of like the golden ticket from Willy Wonka is, you know, and since they announced this, I've seen a couple of different lists of possible contender cities that are, you know, at the top of the list. They had some of the qualifications that they wanted the city where they locate to have. But what are you seeing? I mean, one of the things that I've seen in a lot of these lists is a couple of common names. And Chicago seems to be mentioned in there several times.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Chicago, I think, would have to be seen as a front runner. And here's why. I mean, among these other sort of criteria that Amazon is using, they want, obviously, a tech-friendly city with tens of thousands of software developers. There aren't many cities in the country that have more of those actually than Chicago. There are places like Dallas, Fort Worth, Atlanta, Boston. Kind of a sleeper might be Minneapolis, St. Paul. My friend in economic development, Larry Gigerich of Genovis, says that Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, you know, some other sites in flyover country could be strong. But Amazon wants a place not only with lots of software developers, but more than a million people. It's got to be located near a major international airport. We'll obviously check that with O'Hare. It's got to have strong mass transportation, you know, be walkable, have strong university and college presence. I mean, in all of those areas, Chicago could be a very, very strong competitor. And so, you know, people in the city are taking it very seriously. I know Rahm Emanuel is trying to court Jeff Bezos, with whom he has a relationship. So it's kind of everybody the walls here in Chicago to try and land this.
Now, a couple of the other names that I think we'll probably see some hefty competition from, too, that you haven't mentioned, Atlanta probably and Austin. Those two cities have, you know, lots to offer, just like we do, don't they?
Yeah, Austin obviously has a tech culture, you know, sort of unrivaled by almost any place in the country except probably Silicon Valley and, you know, Boston, the tech corridor there. You know, Nashville is another possibility. And the reason that all these Midwestern cities are getting mentioned is that one thing Amazon wants to accomplish is geographic balance. I mean, basically, they've done so well being headquartered in Seattle that they're just competing against themselves, you know, to hire tech people and with Microsoft. But Silicon Valley's out there as well. That's several hundred miles away. So Amazon's looking to establish another you know, geographic stronghold, and the Midwest seems wide open to that. It will make travel and other business, you know, contingencies easier to be somewhere in the mid part of the country. But also don't write off places like Boston, where General Electric moved its headquarters from Connecticut, and also actually Washington, D.C., which, you know, is just brimming with technology talent, even though the government's always going to compete heavily for that, as well as people like defense contractors and other companies.
I heard, Dale, yesterday somebody say that you know, the sleeper category here could be Canada. And I'm interested in your take on that. I know Toronto is a big city, and this qualification list said North America. It didn't say the U.S., did it?
Yeah, that's an interesting twist. Toronto seems like would be really the only place in Canada that would meet all these criteria, but you know, population-wise, transportation access-wise, it's kind of it's eastern, but it's accessible to the middle part of the country. That's definitely a possibility too. But I'll tell you about Chicago. I mean, even though you know this could end up making Chicago feel much better about not getting Foxconn just to the north, or probably not really having a chance to get the Toyota Mazda plant. You know, Illinois and Chicago are going to be handicapped by the things that are keeping them back generally these days, which is, you know, the high crime rate, which is not something that folks from Amazon are going to be happy about. And also just the fiscal mess in Illinois. I mean, bottom line is any state or city that's going to compete for this is going to have to put together a huge package of incentives, you know, probably hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe in the billions. Mm-hmm. And can Illinois, can Chicago do that at this point? Yeah, that's a problem.
Well, Dale, what is this going to look like in the end, do you think? Are we going to see a giant spaceship campus like Apple? I mean, what do you think this will be? Just a giant suburban or a city building, or what do you foresee?
Well, it's likely to be, you know, close to not necessarily close to a city center, but, you know, perhaps a near suburb. I mean, because it's got to be close to mass transit. It's got to be walkable, Amazon has said. And I don't think it's going to be one big spaceship facility like an Apple ring, you know, descending from the sky. Amazon has said maybe eventually 8 million square feet, but it would be willing to assemble this in a series of buildings, you know, more or less together. And that's kind of what they've done in Seattle, I mean, as they've taken over the town. So it doesn't need a huge greenfield or brownfield site like, for instance, the Foxconn plant is looking for in Wisconsin. It can be kind of assembled within the confines of an urban or, you know, close suburban environment.
What do you think will be the next milepost in this golden ticket haunt here?
Well, I think Amazon has said October 19th or some date in mid-October, I think, is when they said they're actually going to sort of step this up with more discussion of it. I think they probably won't announce the winner until early next year.
All right. Well, we'll be watching. I mean, certainly I've heard all kinds of excitement about this already, so I would imagine that's going to build at a fever pace.
I mean, it has a potential to transform an economy, basically.
Yeah, and I like what you said earlier, too, about it sort of being out, all of it being out there in the open, not, unlike Foxconn, which is sort of done in secret. That deal is going to get done today, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, they're close to closing it. There's still a lot of stuff they have to do legislatively in Wisconsin to line up the incentives and dot the I's, but it's going to happen there, and, you know, maybe Amazon will happen in Chicago.
Well, we can certainly keep our fingers crossed. Dale, thanks, as always, for being with us this morning.
All right, you bet. Thanks, Steve.
Dale Buss with us this morning, a contributor for Chief Executive Magazine for Forbes, and to this program as well. You can follow him on Twitter at Dale D. Buss.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures are pointing toward a positive open on Wall Street, up 49 points right now. NASDAQ futures are higher as well by 13, and S&P futures are up about 4. Let's get the latest now on commodities and agriculture. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. We begin this trading day with a look at very little change in the crop condition report from a week ago. The corn crop percentage harvested stands at 5% nationally, but Texas has 60% of its corn crop harvested, North Carolina 56%, barely underway in Illinois with 2%. The soybean situation conditions down 1% from a week ago, 60% good to excellent in the soybean crop conditions. Looking at some of the major business developments yesterday, Pilgrim's Pride is going to pay $1 billion for the parent of the JBS UK food unit, which is based in Northern Ireland. $1 billion to be paid by Pilgrim's Pride. The numbers in the grain trade yesterday at the close: September wheat down a quarter of a cent, December corn up 1 1/4, and November soybeans down 3/4 of a cent. Not that much change, once again, in the prices over the past 1 week. And then the livestock trade at the Mercantile Exchange saw the October lean hog contract down 45 cents a hundredweight, October cattle up 79 cents, and looking at the big event on the calendar today, Husker Harvest Days, Grand Island, Nebraska, opening day goes through Thursday. That's your money. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a great day as well on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Tuesday, September 12th, 2017. A couple of big things happening today with the economy. Labor Department releases job openings and labor turnover information. The data, the survey for July. The OPEC monthly oil market report is due for September. Also today, there's going to be a auto show getting underway in Frankfurt, the Frankfurt Auto Show, one of the largest in the world. It's a preview day for that, just on the same day that the Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, and the University of Michigan hold a news conference about automated vehicles. We're expecting to see the government start loosening some of the restrictions on the testing on the open roads of automated vehicles. That's likely to happen today. Also, the Apple event in Cupertino, California today, Apple unveiling its new iPhone. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Tuesday, September 12th.